And welcome back. A new IMAX film called A Beautiful Planet opens today at the St. Louis Science Center's Omnimax Theater. It's an exploration of Earth as seen from the International Space Station, and it's narrated by actress Jennifer Lawrence. Contributor Steve Potter helps put the film into focus.
A Beautiful Planet is produced and directed by Tony Myers. James Niehaus is director of photography. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
We're very happy to be here. Thanks.
Tony Myers, this film is a view of our planet that most people will never see or only dream of seeing it this way.
That's why we wanted to do it, to take people right onto the space station alongside the astronaut crew so they could see what the astronauts see exactly as they do it.
That's what IMAX does, and the Omnimax does very well, is take people where they don't go, can't go.
It's shown at the Omnimax Theater here, so that's a little bit different experience than just a regular IMAX presentation.
It is. It's a dome theater, and you sit very close to this big screen, and it really fills your peripheral vision a lot. So you're right in the movie.
When I first started watching this, in the very beginning, I thought I was looking at special effects. No kidding.
It's not special effects. Everything, with the exception of about 15 seconds, that you see in the film is absolutely real. And, of course, the expectation these days is all that's CGI. And it's not. We do two flights through the Milky Way, one to locate our Earth at its address in it, and the other to go out from Earth and look for an exoplanet. And we did that work at the University of Illinois in Champaign at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. And those are all real stars. Every single star that you see is at its real address in 3D space. The only animation that we apply is actually flying through and past them.
Right.
It's all real data.
So from the audience's perspective, we're there on that International Space Station. That's what it's
Absolutely.
Like.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
James, you actually worked with the astronauts because they're the ones that actually shot the footage.
They actually do the filming in space, and Tony and I both work with them a lot. It's a team effort. All these films are team efforts, and the astronauts are part of that team. We teach them, you know, how to shoot for an IMAX screen. They get basic photo training in Astronaut 101, but we take them into a theater, show them things they've shot, and they see what's in focus and what's not and how to fix things.
Is that a learning curve for them? Was this something that – is that easy for them to do?
They're smart people. They're the smartest in, you know –
I've never,
on and off the planet, really.
I've never met one that wasn't absolutely amazing at taking it all in at the first explanation. But that test of having them shoot their own little film and putting it up on a screen that's 60 by 80 feet is the best teaching tool there is, because if the focus button hasn't dropped, they get it then.
Yeah.
Were you able to – I guess you were able to communicate with them while they were – doing the taping over that period of time, right?
For this film, we really had, for the first time, had really not instantaneous communication, but fairly good communication. In the past, we'd have to go through, you know, the backroom channels and the Capcom and all at Houston. But this time, we had email that we could go back and forth, and they actually have a phone system on board the station that they could call you, and you know, your phone rings and the caller ID comes up space station. It's kind of cool.
It is very cool. So the first call, there's nothing like it. There you are in your 90 and, hi, it's the space station call.
Tony, what's it like, though, being a director? This has to be unusual for a director, right, not being on the scene?
We've done this collaboratively for so long, over seven films, actually, that you know you can't launch into space much, though I would like to. So you kind of develop a shorthand in training. And what was good about this particular film, as James said, the communication level was so much higher that you had a far more spontaneous conversation about things. If they were thinking, oh, we'd like to kind of get an idea up there, a shot they'd like to shoot that we hadn't discussed, they'd just call and say, what do you think about this? And then they could shoot it and send it down, and we could see it. And if we didn't like it, we could send them back a PowerPoint on what was the matter with it.
Well, how long was this process? How long were they up there doing this?
15 months the cameras were there. Mm-hmm. And there were three different crews over that period of time that came and went.
Well, so the film is full of things that are happening in the space station, interaction among the astronauts, as well as, you know, shots, visual shots of space. It's also narrated by the actress Jennifer Lawrence, Hunger Games, X-Men, and all that. What was behind that choice?
Well, I certainly knew I wanted a female voice
Why?
For it.
Why?
Well, because we also have a large part of the story told in the astronauts' own words, and three of them were male voices. There was one Italian female astronaut, Samantha Cristoforetti. And I just wanted the balance. And also, I think that the nature of what the film was saying just seemed better to me delivered by a nice female voice.
So. Why have a big name do it? I'm just curious. And I know you've done this in the past. You've done films that are narrated by Leonardo DiCaprio and Jim Carrey,
Tom
Cruise.
I don't really know the numbers or anything. I've never seen a study that said, does that attract an exponentially larger audience? But it certainly is very nice on a poster. Mm-hmm. And it's my genuine hope with Jennifer to reach a different demographic, a much younger audience. When I started off on this project, I definitely wanted to make the film to target young people from elementary and high schools.
A Beautiful Planet. Here's a short segment. It's about 6 or 7 minutes into it, and it begins with Jennifer Lawrence, and then you're going to hear some comments from some of the astronauts.
Butch describes the crazy scene.
As I watched Anton, I mean, he was thrilled and doing flips and excited, floating around, hitting the ceiling. Samantha, the look on her face, just absolutely thrilling. It was literally electric in the room. It was fabulous.
Samantha recalls her first ever view from space.
But I just couldn't resist to take a peek. And I could just see the Earth majestically flowing by. I mean, it was like a river. And, you know, I don't know what happiness is, but I was definitely happy at that time.
What do you see the cupola?
The cupola is a magical window, unlike any other, on the spectacle of our Earth. And ourselves, past, present, and future.
And that's from A Beautiful Planet. We're talking with Tony Myers and James Niehaus. Can you identify who we heard speaking and what's happening?
Yes, it's a marvelous selection of a clip.
Absolutely.
I think I got very emotional listening to it again, although I've seen it hundreds of times. What it describes is the moments immediately after that crew, Samantha Cristoforetti and Terry Virts and Anton, arrived on the station. And Butch Wilmore is narrating with the Tennessee. He says he speaks three languages, English, Russian, and Tennessee.
Right.
And he's there in all his Tennessee glory, describing the reactions of the other two, three people, as they first come into the space station and how overwhelming it is to experience zero G and the size of the station. And then, of course, Samantha just went straight to the window. And
the cupola window, what is that?
The cupola is a viewing platform that was designed specifically for viewing the night sky and Earth. That's its real purpose. And it has an overhead window and six windows around the side. And that's its sole purpose, is for that. And in our previous films, we'd always filmed out of the shuttle windows, which are tiny little windows. And this is really quite a revelation for every astronaut that goes in there.
Yeah, the cupola, if you can imagine being able to stick your head outside the module and have your head in space, that's kind of the view that the cupola gives you with the windows around the circumference and the one overhead window. And it's generally always pointed at Earth, so it's a beautiful platform for seeing the planet.
There are a lot of amusing scenes, and I really like how the astronauts interact with one another. They act like they're having a good time.
Yeah.
There's a scene where one of them is trying to get out of his suit, and he needs help.
Yeah, that's Butch trying to get out of his the hard upper torso of the spacesuit, the spacewalking suit, and he wears one a size too small than what he should, just because it gives him better maneuverability when he's working. Uh-huh. So he puts up with the extrication process, which is quite comical, to be able to do his job better.
Also, they're celebrating Christmas with cookies and milk and hats. So they I guess they try to have a normal life part of the time they're up there.
Try.
Absolutely. I mean, we didn't give them instructions on that scene at all. All I had written on we do a kind of laundry list to start off with, and all I had written was a holiday in space. I didn't specify, uh-huh. and that's what came back. They really like to surprise you.
Mm-hmm. And then there's an amusing scene when they're doing on an exercise machine, like you might see at the gym. Or
yeah.
something. And what they have to exercise, is it 2.5 hours every day?
Two and a half hours. Yep. And Terry,
I mean, that's necessary.
Terry's basically running on the wall, I think, in that one.
Yeah. And why is that necessary?
You want to have a body to come back to. In zero-G, your muscles atrophy because they don't have to do as much work. And you really need to keep that level of exercise up in order to be able to function once you return, especially after 6 months in zero-G or more.
Uh-huh. But it's not all fun. There are the scenes we just described, but you address some serious issues at the same time, like climate change.
Absolutely, and you can see the effects of it very clearly.
Explain how you can you paint that picture?
First of all, you can see the smoke plumes for hundreds of miles from the fires in the Amazon basin.
And you can see that from the space station.
You can see that from the space station.
And you can look straight down and see the deforestation tracks where the dark carpet of forest has just been carved in straight lines for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles. And what we're saying there is that those smoke plumes are spewing stuff into the atmosphere and it's causing the temperatures to change along with the fossil fuels that we burn so much of. Mm-hmm. And so the next scene that you see after that is a monster pollution cloud over China that is – you can't even see China. We talk about how then it kind of rockets over into other effects. It's affecting our water supply. So the glaciers high in the mountains are melting. It's causing the drought in California because the snowpack isn't there anymore. So we have extensive sequences on those things that was all there to shoot.
So how many miles out is the space station?
The typical orbit is about 250 miles up.
Isn't it odd that you have to go that far away to take a closer look at the planet where we live?
That's really...
Well, whoever coined the phrase, you can't see the forest for the trees.
Mm-hmm.
He nailed it because that's exactly what you have to do. To get that perspective also on the positive things, which is a very important part of the film that we wanted to convey, is that it's a beautiful planet, as the title says. And sometimes it's hard to see that when you're on the ground until you get away and you actually see it as a complete entity and a whole planet. Then you see how wonderful it is.
One point that A Beautiful Planet makes, too, is when you talk about you're seeing the ill effects of climate change and all that. One of the messages is there are things we can do to save our planet.
Yep, it's the Chesapeake Bay is one of the examples. Is back in the 70s, you couldn't eat fish from the Chesapeake, and there was laws prohibiting you from catching fish. And now it's they've brought it back, made changes around the area, and it's back into a really nice place to visit.
Part of this too, you include a resource guide that educators can use, and it's pretty extensive. It talks about things like astronauts spending time in water, having to perform many different experiments each day. Tell me how that works, the educational component of this.
We've always, with every one of our 7 space films, put out an educator's guide so that we have a big program, most theaters, where school groups come to the theaters with classes of different ages, and then they can go back and study and discuss what they've seen over time in the classroom. So that's really what the educator's guide is helping to stimulate that discussion. And, you know, kids are just fantastic. This is the reason I wanted to speak to them specifically, because they really embrace this topic. I think older people seem to be, you know, downtrodden with paying the rent and the daily grind. And kids really, really get it. And they spread the word, and they have an emotional attachment that I don't see so much in older people. And I think it's great that in the class they can take this guide, go back, especially to develop another thread that I have in the film, is the metaphor of the space station and Earth as both being closed-loop life support systems. And so they get to see all that it takes on the space station to keep six people alive over time where they're outside. There isn't any air. There isn't any water. There's nothing. How complex a machine that needs to be to sustain a few human beings. Well, the Earth is exactly the same. And the only difference with that is that Earth doesn't get any resupply ships.
That's Tony Myers, producer and director of A Beautiful Planet. We're also talking to James Niehaus, director of photography. It's interesting, some of your work in the past, you've both done work on the other side of the coin, sort of underwater, below the ocean.
That's correct. And
didn't you do similar films from that perspective?
Only airless environments, it seems.
Why is that?
well, in that case, I couldn't claim James is a bona fide diver. I am not, and two of the films that I've worked on, Howard Hall, a filmmaker who's an excellent, excellent director and producer in his own right, we worked together. And so it's similar to the astronaut equation where he's going down to the bottom of the ocean and shooting stuff that you later see and have input on. They're both, again, environments where the average person perhaps can't go themselves, and they are wonderful, wonderful worlds that people can be transported to inside a theater that they normally wouldn't experience, which is why we like underwater, too.
Here's another clip from A Beautiful Planet. This is towards the end.
What struck me looking at Earth on space is the fact that you can really perceive it visually as a spacecraft. I've heard before about, you know, spaceship Earth, but when you are up there, you really cannot escape that notion. It's totally obvious that it is a celestial body that is carrying all of us, all of humanity, all of life on Earth, on this journey through space. And just like the space station is, you know, a human-made outpost out there that allows us to survive in this hostile environment of space, well, you know, our Earth does the same for all of us.
Samantha is utterly amazing. You couldn't write those words as beautifully as she spoke them spontaneously. And she managed to sum up what it had taken me 4 years to
figure
kind
out,
of get together as the theme for a film. She just got it in one or two sentences like that. And it's the essence of what I was trying to convey.
Yeah, this film, more than any of the other ones, has really opened my eyes to the fact that, yeah, we're in a very unique situation here in this universe, in this galaxy, and we've got a very special place to live here, and we got to not screw it up any more than we already are and take care of it better.
What kind of feedback have you heard from people who have seen it, non-scientists?
The response to the film has been utterly overwhelming to me in the positive sense. People come and say, thank you, thank you, thank you for making this film. Thank you for making it for my children. Mm-hmm. Thank you for making it for me. It's been absolutely amazing. I thought that there would be some argument, you know. I was prepared for a kind of pushback, and that may yet come.
Yeah.
But so far, it's been absolutely positive. I mean, on the commercial side, 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. I've never heard of that before. That's 100% positive, not rotten.
James, here's a question for you. Okay. You know, we've talked with directors of other IMAX films before, and there seems to be this divide between film purists and those who prefer digital technology.
Right.
So how do you
come
down on that?
Well, that's a wonderful question for me. I've always said I'll stop shooting film when they pry it from my cold, dead hands. but with this film, we were we were in the situation where we couldn't fly film, physical film, to space just because there's no space shuttle. We can't get it up. We can't get it back. So we were kind of forced into the digital realm with this. And fortunately, it's worked well. I mean, I think the images are beautiful. And for me to say that, I think is probably one of the best, you know, comments on digital technology you can get. We got things with this, with the digital system, that we wouldn't have gotten with film, and we're able to shoot more things, and it made the film.
Well, to my untrained eye, I thought it was beautiful and captivating on many levels.
Thank you.
One last question for you both. What is the Goldilocks zone?
The Goldilocks zone is a region, it's not a region. There are many Goldilocks zones. In the Milky Way, a satellite called Kepler has been looking around for planets around other stars. And the way Kepler does that is that it detects when an object passes in front of a star. And as it crosses in front of a star, they can tell that that's planetary activity there. What Goldilocks means is they can also judge, the satellite data can also tell them the distance. They can calculate the distance of those planets around the star, how far away they are. And if they're too far away, then they're too cold. If they're too inside, then they're too hot. So it's not too hot, not too cold, just perfect.
That's right.
And it's the Goldilocks zone. And there are, when we started on this sequence, Frank Summers at the Space Telescope Science Institute said, you know, really, astronomers are leaning towards the fact that there may be at least one planet around every single star in the Milky Way. I mean, that is just mind-boggling to try to imagine. But at the time we started, they had definitely confirmed about 4,000 of them. But they're very, very, very far away. The Kepler-186 system that we have in the film is 500 light years away. And we're not going there anytime soon.
No.
Well, there's a lot to ponder.
It's
a beautiful job. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
That's contributor Steve Potter talking with producer-director Tony Myers and director of photography James Naismith. The new IMAX film, A Beautiful Planet, opens today at the St. Louis Science Center's Omnimax Theater. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at what was and was not accomplished in the session of the Missouri Legislature that ends at 6 o'clock this evening. We'll also hear the next installment of the We Live Here podcast, exploring the Missouri Legislature's response to the 2014 events in Ferguson. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and Kelly Moffitt, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Valita Brown, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. Arts and culture programming on St. Louis on the Air is funded in part by the Arts and Education Council of Greater St. Louis, the Regional Arts Commission, and the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. And today we say goodbye and thank you to our intern, Valita Brown, for her contributions to our efforts during the last 4 months. We also congratulate her on her graduation from Washington University and wish her well in her future pursuits. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.